Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 8, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm not actually here tonight. I'm coming to you on recording. I'm off at a conference on globalization at Grinnell College in Iowa. Never been to Iowa before. It's rather an exotic experience for me. So I don't know what to expect as I'm recording this on Tuesday night, but we shall see. I've got one guest scheduled for tonight, just a long interview with the author Chalmers Johnson, who I think first made his fame as a scholar of Japan, Japanese political economy, but has been lately writing about the effects of U.S. empire. He had a book called Blowback that came out several years ago, and now he's got a book called The Sorrows of Empire, which takes the measure of the U.S. imperial presence around the world, its effects on us and them. We'll get to that in a few minutes, but first the usual economic headlines. Last Friday, we got the release of the U.S. Employment Report, which, as I've said here many times, is probably the most important single release that the U.S. government statistical machinery produces. The recession officially ended in November 2001, but we got really very little job growth after that. Actually, job decline for a good bit of that period. And things finally started turning around late last year, last several months of 2003 and the first couple of months of 2004 did show some positive job numbers, but quite weak ones. We saw in the space of 4 or 5 months what you would generally see in a good month of job growth in earlier historical periods. When the Labor Department reported on Friday morning that the U.S. economy added 308,000 jobs in March, that was quite a surprise. It was much higher than anyone was expecting, including me. And it was the best number we'd seen in about 3 years. So really, first signs of that the job market is catching fire. Now, a lot of people on the left have historically greeted these things rather skeptically, and this was certainly not a blowout report. There were some weak points in it, which I'll talk about in a minute. But 308,000 is a serious number, and if it's continued, then that whole period of a jobless recovery has indeed come to an end. But like I said, this is 1 month. This doesn't make a trend, but there is some sign of a turn here. Most major sectors in the economy added jobs. Construction added 71,000. Retail added 47,000. Even government added, even though there's been pressure on state and local governments. The federal government has been shrinking mostly. Local government did add about 31,000 new employees. So most of the major industrial sectors in the positive column for March. Actually, manufacturing, which had been declining for 43 consecutive months, a streak with no historical precedent, even in the Rust Belt era of the early 1980s, finally, a zero achievement in the manufacturing sector, no change. And I guess down so long, zero looks like up to me. But the U.S. government does two surveys of employment. One is a survey of employers, the so-called establishment survey, and the other is a survey of households. The establishment survey covers about 400,000 employing establishments, which collectively employ about a third of the U.S. workforce. And it's a very, very large sample, probably about as big a sample as anything in the social sciences you could find. It's not perfect. It sometimes misses new firms or firms that go out of business. So it's not a perfect sample, but it's very good. They also do a survey of households. And the household survey is a source of the familiar unemployment numbers. But there are also measures of employment in the household side as well. And that is decidedly weaker. There is actually a shrinkage in employment by that measure, an increase in the number of people who are working part-time for economic reasons, that is, people who want full-time work but could only find part-time work, a decline in the number of people with full-time jobs, an increase in the number of people who were losing their job permanently, that is, as opposed to people who were on temporary layoff expecting to be recalled, or people who are just freshly joining the labor force or re-entering the labor force who could also be unemployed. There was a significant increase in the number of people who were losing their jobs permanently, which is unusual in when we're expecting a labor market turnaround. Other signs of weakness on the establishment survey were a decline in the average work week, down by 6 minutes, a tenth of an hour, which is generally not something you see when the labor market is picking up, and also stagnation in average wages. The U.S. economy saw a decline in the real wage running from 1973 through 1995, and that came to an end about 1995. And from 1995 through sometime last year, average real wages, that is, wages corrected for inflation, were rising, which is something they hadn't been doing for 20, 25 years previously. But that has come to a halt, and we don't know whether this is just an artifact of the recent recession and weak recovery or a longer-term trend. We had a long expansion in the 1980s that came along with declining real wages, so we may be seeing a repeat of that. It's too early to tell that, but something that bears closer watching. So, in sum, some good news, but we're not out of the woods yet, but we are certainly, it certainly feels like we may be getting there. Also, another indicator, the Conference Board's survey of chief executives shows them in much more optimistic moods, much more inclined to hire and to expand in the coming months. So that also is a portent, perhaps, of a strengthening economy as the year goes on. And as I said earlier, the usual leftish instinct is to be very skeptical, be very pessimistic, to think that these numbers are cooked or misleading or phony or just a flash in the pan. I would counsel against that right now. Keep an open mind, at least. It's certainly, this is not rock-solid evidence of an accelerating expansion, but there are certainly hints of that, which we should take seriously. And now just a couple of announcements, a repeat of something from last week. The Union for Radical Political Economics, URPE, an organization of which I've been a member for many, many years, is sponsoring an event at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street in New York City, 10th floor, next Wednesday, April 14th, 7:30 p.m. Lights Out, Privatization and the Deregulation of Electricity, featuring Nomi Prins, Gordian Raki, and Rini Toback. They will be talking about the structure of utility deregulation, what it means for consumers, what it means for the environment, and also Wall Street's nefarious role in the whole project. So that's, again, Lights Out, Privatization and the Deregulation of Electricity at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street in Manhattan, next Wednesday, April 14th at 7:30 p.m. Also next week, Friday, April 16th at 6:30 p.m., The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communications Politics in the 21st Century, a discussion featuring Robert McChesney and Mark Crispin Miller. Robert McChesney also has a new book, The Problem of the Media, just published by Monthly Review Press, and I'll be talking to him in a couple of weeks about that book. I have a very high regard for the work of Robert McChesney, but I'm not so sure about his companion on that panel, Mark Crispin Miller. I think he's got a fairly superficial analysis of the media, and I'm also rather worried about his musical judgment. Here is an excerpt from a demo tape he was circulating some years ago, Queen of the Forest. Listen and make up your own mind.
Will you want me the queen of the forest? I'll make you the queen of the town. With a coffee bar and a florist and the neon and chrome for your crown. No, you won't.
And that was NYU professor Mark Crispin Miller in an excerpt from a demo tape he was circulating several years ago, Queen of the Forest. And if that's the kind of media he's looking for, I think I might prefer Time Warner. And now let's turn to our main feature of the evening, an interview with Chalmers Johnson, author of the book The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Chalmers published a book several years ago called Blowback about the risks of how imperial adventures might do us harm, a book that proved to be prophetic on September 11th, 2001. And now he's taking a look at what the U.S. Empire does to the world and to us, its threat to the people of the world and to our democracy. Since Johnson first made his reputation as a scholar of Japan, though, I thought I'd spend the first few minutes of the interview looking for his view of that country's economic recovery. So let's start with that and then move on to the other segments of the interview. Chalmers Johnson. First, before we get to your book, just a few words about Japan. Seem to be... Well, of course, all the Anglo-American pundits were writing off Japan as pretty much a dead letter, but now it looks like the Japanese economy does seem to be maybe recovering for real after several false starts. What's your view of things right now?
It's extremely difficult to judge this. That is, to the extent that it is recovering, it's because of individual companies making their own very delayed adjustments. The reforms of the Koizumi government simply have not been implemented. It's all talk, but very, very little genuine action in the way of structural reform. And at the same time, we have a real lurch to the right in Japanese politics, a sort of demonization of China in the from official sources, while at the same time the two economies become much more thoroughly integrated every day. The Japanese seem, it's hard to say, again, also terrified about North Korea, but at the same time, it's not clear that they're really terrified about North Korea as much as they wish to involve the United States into their various regional difficulties. I'd say that there's no doubt Japan remains a manufacturing powerhouse. Automotive industry is doing particularly well, but that in areas of structural reform, like the banking system, bringing under control the monstrous national debt, the largest of any major industrial power, still, you'd have to say, the Liberal Democratic Party talks a big war, but does nothing.
What about the relationship with China? How much of the apparent recovery in Japan recently is due to demand for, say, capital equipment from China?
Very much so. I mean, that is to say, the Chinese economy grew at 9.1% last year. It's easily the fastest growth rate for any of the big economies. It is the fastest growing economy on Earth today. Japan is certainly not the only country taking advantage of this, though. It also, I would think, South Korea is, China is now South Korea's leading trading partner. Japan is investing in China, but at the same time it seems reluctant, and the the background noise of Sino-Japanese hostility still continues. The Prime Minister says that he will continue to make visits to Yasukuni Shrine, which the Chinese deeply resent, since buried there are the... enshrined there are the shades of the war criminals from World War II, such as General Tojo, who carried out monstrous war crimes in China and have never apologized for them. So that it's a, it remains a very difficult relationship, and one has the strong sense that the Japanese still do not understand, or in any case are underestimating, the force of Chinese nationalism, as they often go out of their way, it seems, to insult the Chinese.
From this distance, it seemed so simple that if Japan had socialized its banking losses years ago the way we did, they might have been a little further down the road to recovery. What was inhibiting them? To me, it looked almost like there was a paralysis among the political class that made that impossible. What's your analysis?
Well, that is the term, paralysis among the political class. It's above all the fear of altering the structure of the society that produced the spectacular growth rates of the 1960s and 1970s. My view of it is Japan now begins to understand that it should have changed its economic policies, foreign economic policies, in the mid-1980s when it became the world's largest creditor nation and the United States became the world's largest debtor nation. Instead, it chose to tie itself ever more completely to the United States and to help finance America's monstrous trade deficits. This, I believe, has locked them in to an antiquated system of depending upon exports to the American market that has paralyzed their ability to take advantage of the real dynamic developments in East Asia, which are above all the emergence of China as a probably the most capitalist of countries on earth today.
At the same time, it looks like China is following parts of the Japanese model in that they're financing U.S. trade deficits at the same time they're selling lots of manufactured goods to us.
No doubt, that's absolutely true. But I think also China is becoming a very important market of choice for much of the third world, for countries like Brazil and others, in that China is going to absorb enormous amounts of food, raw materials, petroleum, things of this sort. That Japan played that role to a certain extent, but China is much more open to foreign direct investment. It is the world's largest recipient of foreign direct investment after Great Britain and the United States. This gives it a much greater flexibility as time goes on, and what you see is the seeming fear in Japan of the emergence of real competition from China. I believe it's a misplaced fear. The two economies are utterly complementary. If they would only learn truly to cooperate with each other, they will become, without doubt, the manufacturing center of the world. But the old attitudes and the heritage of World War II still continues to influence them.
But what do you make of Japan sending, 1,000 troops to Iraq? Is this Japan's coming out as a world power? Are they shredding the peace constitution? What do you see?
Well, they're certainly shredding the peace constitution, and as I say, the whole society, at least the political class, seems to be lurching to the right. The explanation for it has nothing to do with Iraq or oil or the Middle East or any belief in American foreign policy. It is, above all, the problems of North Korea. They believe they are vulnerable to the North Korean weapons program and to the fact that it does have missiles that could hit in Japan, and that they see their defense coming primarily from the United States. Therefore, Koizumi has tied himself to Bush even in an even more obsequious manner than Tony Blair or Aznar in Spain or Berlusconi in Italy. This is not popular with the mass of the population, but one of the most amazing phenomena we see in the world today, of course, is major, large democracies simply turning their backs on the democratic will of the public. I believe that Japan is clearly overstating any threat from North Korea, which is a defensive power above all. That is, its weapons program is a deterrent against the United States. And I believe most people know that. But for reasons that are not entirely clear, the leadership in Japan is using this war scare, if you will, to reform the Constitution, to move Japan in a much more militaristic direction, to energize the arms industry, to work on things like ballistic missile defense, all of which is alarming to the other essentially commercial powers of East Asia.
And should we see that as an attempt to move independently of the United States, or will they be integrated into a whole U.S. Imperial force structure?
They may ultimately move independently of the United States, but right now they are obsequiously in line. That Koizumi, Blair is Bush's poodle, Koizumi is his Cocker Spaniel, that all they have to do is raise an eyebrow and the Japanese come running to ask what it is that the Americans want. So that there is no sign of independence right now, despite continued tensions in places like Okinawa with 38 American military bases, and a mayor of the world's largest city of Tokyo, Mr. Ishihara, who daily condemns the American base at the American air base at Yokota. So the tensions remain, but the government never seemed more totally in line behind the United States, and there's been a flurry of speculation in the Japanese press about what would they do if Kerry were elected president, since they feel they do not have much in the way of a pipeline to him.
Mayor of Tokyo, is he the fellow who wrote the Japan Who Could Say No?
Yes.
So he's saying no on a bigger stage now.
He is certainly, and he certainly represents a new resurgent nationalism in Japan, and he's on the right. But he's also very popular because he tweaks the central government, and he continuously needles them for their servility toward the United States.
And that was Chalmers Johnson speaking about Japan. And now let's listen to the first section of the interview in which he talks about his new book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, just published by Metropolitan Books.
All right, well, let's switch to your book now, The Sorrows of Empire.
Yes.
There are some people who argue that the Bush administration really is not much of a departure from U.S. political military strategies of the past. It's really just a continuation of the kind of push to global domination that the U.S. aspired to after the end of World War II. Do you see this as some sort of continuum, or is there really some sort of departure in the last several years?
Well, certainly I argue in my book that there is a continuum. I try to make the case that if you are committed to the American imperial project, that is global military dominance of the world, Bill Clinton was actually a more effective imperialist than George Bush, because he attempted to disguise, in the classic essence of strategy, the indirect approach, to disguise what we were doing under rubrics like humanitarian intervention or globalization or things like that. The real difference is that the neoconservatives who dominate the Pentagon and who more or less set foreign policy in the government have dropped the facade. They now openly proclaim with a certain amount of glee that we are the new Rome, that we intend to maintain domination over all of the world, friends as well as enemies. Through use of military force, ultimately from bases in outer space that we're in the process of constructing right now. So there is a huge amount of continuity in the American imperial project. There is, I think, one other very significant difference, however, that certainly complicates the American world. George Bush has rather decisively dropped the policies of the Clinton administration and of all previous American administrations to attempt some kind of equitable reconciliation between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that Bush seems to have adopted, or virtually copying Ariel Sharon's policies and the right wing of the Likud party. This, of course, has the effect of causing the United States to lose virtually all credibility that it ever had in the Islamic world, even in places I've traveled quite extensively in Indonesia. 4 years ago, 80% of the population was favorable to the United States. Today, those numbers are reversed. 80% say they distrust the United States. This is the world's largest Islamic country. So there certainly are differences. I think also the military budget is today close to being out of control. It very likely is actually out of control, particularly given the fact that allocating funds to the military, we're not supplying the actual funds to do it. We're borrowing from the future by going deeply into debt. You do not see even the hint of fiscal responsibility in the Bush administration. That clearly was probably the greatest achievement of the Clinton administration. So there are differences, but in terms of the overall continuity of the imperial project, this goes back really to World War II. That the thing that brought it into the open was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, and that instead of demobilizing and declaring a peace dividend and returning to civilian pursuits, the United States, in my view, as I try to argue in the book, made a disastrous error. It concluded that it had won the Cold War. The truth of the matter is it simply didn't lose it as badly or as rapidly as the former Soviet Union, and the collapse of the Soviet Union had absolutely nothing to do with anything that came from the United States or elsewhere abroad. It was essentially an internal phenomenon that I'd be glad to go into if you want to. But it's in concluding that we had won the Cold War, we then went further and concluded that we were, as I say, a new Rome, a colossus athwart the world, that Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, virtually quotes the old Roman line about we do not care whether we are loved so long as we are feared, and that this, I think you'd have to say the American empire was ultimately going to decline anyway, but under the Bush administration, it is declining much more rapidly than it need have. But the thing that startled me above all was after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the removal of what I regarded at the time as a genuine menace to us and to our allies, we saw the American government turn and in a frantic search to find replacement enemies and to prop up the Cold War structures and to perpetuate the interests of the military-industrial complex in a way that is very possibly, is today, irreversible.
I've been surprised over the last couple of years that we haven't seen more complaints from what we might think of as the grown-ups in the political establishment, people who might be alarmed by the mendacity, the arrogance, and fiscal irresponsibility. You've talked about the fact that we've alienated so much of the world's population in so short a space of a time. What do you attribute this relative assent or complacency to?
Ever so late, we're beginning to hear from the likes of Zbigniew Brzezinski in his new book, a very disappointing book in my view, but nonetheless, it does reflect the foreign affairs establishment beginning to worry about the antics of our boy emperor. One of the things you would have to say is that the political system simply isn't working. It's failing us, that the imperial presidency has now become so powerful that it has simply made the Congress into a cipher and is increasingly packing the judicial system. But to explain it, I would think, is going to be something for historians over a long period of time. I would right now cite, above all, simply lack of information among the general public due to the failure of our journalism. That is with most TV news under the control of entertainment conglomerates and with a kind of obsequiousness on the part of papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, where they seem so proud of their being a part of the establishment that they become virtually organs for it, that the public simply does not know what's going on. That's one of the reasons why I wrote my book, because it's intended to provide an inattentive public, to try and mobilize an inattentive public to some information that I know they don't have because of secrecy and things of this sort. They are ensured that they do not have it, but that they desperately need, particularly the size of our military empire, namely 725 military bases in other people's countries on all the continents of the world. And this is the number acknowledged by the Pentagon. The actual number is even higher than that. But I would say lack of information. The press in some ways seems to have misunderstood that the First Amendment was not enacted to protect People magazine. The purpose of the First Amendment, of freedom of the press, was to provide the press with the authorization to penetrate the greatest single weapon of a large state bureaucracy, namely its ability to keep what it does secret. Press is supposed to try and penetrate that and expose the pretensions of comfortable bureaucrats. Instead, we wait today, as we did in the Vietnam War, for people like Dan Ellsberg or most recently Richard Clark, influential insiders with information who finally come forward and reveal to the world what documents that prove what we all suspected, and that the press has, as generally speaking, I believe, failed disastrously to even pay attention to.
One of the interesting parts of your book is you survey the extent of the American bases around the world, and also look at the culture of the U.S. military. So let's look at each of those things in turn. First, just how big is the U.S. presence? So give us some sense of how big, how many bases, where they are, but also how they fit into the local culture, if they do at all.
Well, this is, I think, the thing that no American can understand, since there are no American bases no foreign bases in the United States. I live in San Diego. If you'd had, say, a division of Turkish troops in downtown San Diego for the last 50 years, I believe that we would have continuous running battles every Saturday night between young American men and young Turkish men. That's the condition in Okinawa, with 38 American military bases that have been there since the Battle of Okinawa at the end of World War II, and then from the heights of the Cold War, when we directly governed Okinawa as a Pentagon colony, and at the point of a bayonet, we drove people off their land and then bulldozed their houses in order to build these Cold War establishments. It is one of the things that led me into this book was a visit to Okinawa in February 1996, just after the very serious incident of September 4th, 1995, in which two Marines and a sailor from Camp Hansen had abducted, beaten, and raped a 12-year-old Okinawan girl. It led to the greatest single demonstrations against the United States since the Japanese-American Security Treaty had been signed. The commander of American forces in Japan at the time was General Richard Myers, who is, of course, today chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Myers at the time took the typical American military line that this was a tragic incident, but in no way typical of American forces, that it was a three bad apples, as he put it. 99.9% of the American troops were wonderful, upright citizens. As a result of my research, the research of the Okinawan Prefectural Police, of an organization called Okinawan Women Act Against Military Violence that was created after the rape, as well as some very important investigative journalism by the Detroit Daily News. They're located directly next door to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We've now revealed or demonstrated that the rate of sexually violent crimes leading to court-martial by our troops in Okinawa runs at 2 per month and has for well over 50 years, including just this past month. So that, yes, the prices paid by the people living in 130 countries around the world for our presence include environmental damage, noise pollution, drunken brawls, drunken driving, bar fights, and certainly the continued threat of sexual violence. The Air Force has now, of course, just revealed that in the Pacific, they have rates of American servicemen, American airmen, raping women in the Air Force at a rate considerably more than 2 per month, these leading also to court-martial or to other disciplinary action, which is important since, without question, in a place like Okinawa, the rape of an adult woman, very commonly she is so humiliated she wouldn't think of coming forward, that's what happened when they raped a child, a 12-year-old girl, is when this whole morass came into the open. But that, yes, these are very, very serious problems. The American public likes to think that we are known abroad because of our popular culture, because of our music, because of Hollywood movies. The truth of the matter is, foreigners around the world, if they ever encounter an American, which they're certainly going to, they're much more likely to meet an 18 to 24-year-old member of the Special Forces, which I say are located in at least 130 countries right now. The extent of this empire is hard to imagine. It exists from Japan to South America, from Greenland to Australia, 725 bases, military bases, which does not, of course, include our espionage bases, the bases in England that are disguised as Royal Air Force bases. The Pentagon's base structure report, for various complex and secretive reasons, omits the 14 bases we're building in Iraq as we talk, the bases we're building in Afghanistan, the bases in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, most of the bases around the Persian Gulf, the huge Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo in the Balkans that was built by Kellogg Brown and Root, subsidiary of Cheney's Halliburton Company, in 1999, the biggest base we've built since the Vietnam War. It's a very odd life that goes on there too. It's a closed internal world, and I mean the subtitle of my book, "Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic." Most of it is secret in that journalists very rarely attempt to cover it, and when they do, the military has become past masters of manipulating the press. It's something they learned from the Vietnam War, where so many of them concluded that they lost it only because they had not controlled the press. Now they devote massive resources to to doing just that. Also, you must remember that the people in the armed forces today are not citizen soldiers. These are, it's not an obligation of citizenship to serve in the armed forces, and has not been since 1973. It's a career choice, and it very often reflects people in our society who, trying to evade one or another dead end of American life, have joined the armed forces. That's why African Americans are twice as well represented in the Army as they are in the society. 50% of the women in the armed forces are national minorities. I always thought a good example of this was PFC Jessica Lynch, who was wounded at Nasiriya in the assault on Baghdad. When asked by the press why did she join the Army, she said, "I couldn't get a job at Walmart in Palestine, West Virginia. I essentially joined the Army to get out of Palestine, West Virginia." Perfectly logical kind of career choice, except, of course, she did not expect to be shot at, and she was more or less promised by the recruiters she wouldn't be until we got caught up in this quagmire of Iraq. But this is what I'm trying to do in the book, is through a great deal of detail, trying to back up everything I have to say with citations and to write it in as open and as non-academic a way as I possibly can, the details on this world. It's not necessarily a bad world. There's for these 725 bases, the armed forces maintains, for example, the armed forces ski center at Garmisch in the Bavarian Alps, luxury hotels in downtown Seoul and Tokyo, well over 200 armed forces golf courses around the world, 71 Learjet luxury jets to fly admirals and generals to them when they want to go. It's a it appeals to a certain type of American who likes state socialism, cradle-to-grave security, a pension afterwards. It is also unimaginably expensive, probably running today by the best analyses of, say, the Center for Defense Information, as probably, once you include in pensions, atomic energy, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the $400 billion ostensible defense budget, it probably is running $750 billion, which is also money that we're not actually paying for it. We're just allocating it and putting it off to the future in the federal deficit.
We're listening to an interview with Chalmers Johnson, author of the book The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, just published by Metropolitan Books. This is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM on your radio dial, and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. And let's take a little musical break and listen to the first of five piano pieces by Arnold Schoenberg, Opus 23, performed by Glenn Gould.
About 7 or 8 years ago, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal talking about how, for the first time in our history as a country, we have this professional army, standing professional army, that had developed its own independent culture that was contemptuous of the indiscipline of civilian life.
Of course, let's remember that's exactly what George Washington warned us against in his farewell address when he spoke of the dangers of a standing army. And he wasn't an isolationist. He was talking about how it unbalanced the system of separation of powers written into our Constitution. It's the same point Eisenhower was getting at even more forcefully in his farewell address, and both of these, of course, were two famous generals who became presidents, but in which he invented the phrase military-industrial complex and warned us as unambiguously as he could of the unwarranted power that the military was beginning to exercise. What you see today is the military expanding into numerous other areas in our life where we, in the past, by tradition or by law, did not believe that it was appropriate for uniformed military officers to be present. You just have to say today that we ought to go back and call it again the Department of War, as we did before 1947, since it's anything but a Department of Defense. It's an alternative focus of government on the south bank of the Potomac River.
Well, it's interesting, after September 11th, they had to create a Department of Homeland Security. I thought that was what the Defense Department was supposed to be, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I'll just take one example, that we've never in the past in the United States had a military regional command charged with the defense of the United States directly, I mean, and able to intervene in domestic affairs. This was the Posse Comitatus Act, passed after the Civil War, when the military intervened in an election in the South. Was just as controversial as the election of 2000. The Posse Comitatus Act says that uniformed forces can never be used for domestic policing so long as our courts are open and functioning. We now have something called the Northern Command, based at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado. During World War II, we refused to ever create such a command explicitly because of the fear that it would become a focus for a military usurpation of civilian power. The current commander, General Eberstadt, has been quoted as saying that he feels it's one of his responsibilities today is to investigate whether we still need the Posse Comitatus Act, since it might interfere with his duties. One wants to say, General Eberstadt, the truth of the matter is the Posse Comitatus Act is not something you should be concerned about, because we enacted it to protect ourselves from you.
It does seem like we're seeing this militarization of everything around us. And,
yes.
Bush's constant presentation of himself as a war president is really designed, you know, to create this sense of discipline and purpose, but also, you know, stifle dissent. And one of the themes of your book is how this empire abroad, you know, threatens democracy at home. So how can this be fought?
Well, that is the number one question of the age. It may actually be too late. I mean, that some of the most amazing speeches being given these days are being given by that almost our Ciceroan figure, Senator Robert Byrd, very elderly senator from West Virginia, who is speaking to empty Senate chambers, but in some of the most impassioned and erudite and well-informed speeches about the nature of our government and the threat to the Republic caused by out-of-control power. I mean, simply to say, if, for example, you had a president and a Congress who wished to exercise oversight over these huge forces today, I just have to say they can't do it. 40% of the defense budget is secret, and talk about continuity, it has been secret since World War II, since the Manhattan Project to build atomic weapons. You can't do oversight if you can't find out how the money is being spent, in direct contradiction of the first article of our Constitution, which guarantees the public the right to an annual, accurate accounting of how their tax money has been spent. That has not been true in the United States for 50 years, and our Supreme Court has agreed to it. Similarly, all the budgets of the secret intelligence agencies are beyond any form of public scrutiny. That secrecy is almost out of control. The end of the Republic? Well, take just one example. Easily the most important author of the Constitution of 1787, James Madison, writing in the Federalist Papers, said the single most important article in the Constitution is that the right to go to war is reserved for the elected representatives of the people. He went on to say, never under any circumstance should this power be granted to a single man. The responsibility is simply too great. Well, in October of 2002, our Congress voted to give that power to a single man, to exercise it when he felt like it, without any further legitimation. including the use of nuclear weapons if he chose to, and the following March, he put that power into effect in an attack on Iraq. We now have ample reason to believe that he engineered this vote by the Congress by sending them a false national intelligence estimate that he had ordered the Central Intelligence Agency to prepare, that one that basically provided intelligence to back up statements made by Vice President Cheney in the summer of 2002. Until October of 2002, there hadn't been a national intelligence estimate on Iraq for several years, strongly suggesting that the agency charged with supplying information to the government on foreign threats had never regarded Iraq as a threat at all. These are, I would think, if one believes that it's an impeachable offense to dally with a female employee in your office, these certainly strike me as impeachable offenses, but the term is virtually forbidden in our public discussion today, which is, again, a sign of saying, I mean, Senator Byrd believes that this situation can be reversed, that the public, once it realizes what it's about to lose in the form of its Republican liberties, that's Republican with a little R, that they will rise up and reestablish democracy. I am myself not nearly so sure. The only truly optimistic thing I see going for us and the world is the fact that a year ago, 10 million people demonstrated around the world in all of the genuine democracies against the war, against George Bush, and for democracy. The largest demonstrations in British history, 2 million people, 400,000 in New York City, a million each in Berlin, Madrid, it's worth noting, in Rome. Those people haven't gone away. In fact, one of the ideas that came out at the World Social Forum in Bombay in January was that the equation that we should be working on today is no bases equals no empire, which equals no war, and that one of the tasks of the 10 million activists around the world should be to draw attention to American bases in their countries and to do everything in their power to have them closed and the Americans told to take their military and go home. At the same time, I'm reminded that Adlai Stevenson, when he was running for president in one of his campaign stops, a woman stood up and said to him, Mr. Stevenson, you have every intellectual in the country behind you. And he said, that's great, but what I need is a majority. I don't see that we have a majority that is prepared to bring the military-industrial complex, the Pentagon, the secret intelligence agencies back under democratic control. And so long as that is the case, they will continue to expand until we collapse like the former Soviet Union did in 1991.
Yeah, let's close on that because the conventional idea of an empire is that you're supposed to profit from it by exploiting foreign colonies.
Yes.
On the other hand, it looks like the expense of running this empire is driving us into fiscal ruin. So what's the future of this? Are we going to spend ourselves into penury or?
The classic example of the Roman Republic, which for two centuries enjoyed very considerable civil liberties and was in fact a model for many of the ideas in our Constitution, it of course succumbed ultimately to military dictatorship in that the military grew so large as a function of it sort of thoughtlessly acquiring an empire. It acquired an empire and then discovered it no longer had citizen armies raised to defend the country. No one objects to the idea of defense of the country, and militarism doesn't mean that. It means vested interests in a military way of life, in a military way of making a living, in expanding the arms industry, things like that. The Romans ultimately discovered that the military had such strong vested interests, it began to create, if you will, its own political leaders. By far the most famous of the military populace was, of course, Julius Caesar. After he was assassinated in 44 BC in the Senate, this then went on to his grandnephew, Octavian, who in 27 BC became the god Augustus Caesar and established military dictatorship, which is what prevailed through the rest of what we call the Roman Empire. As I was writing an essay on this past fall, I was startled when 2 weeks after I posted it on the Internet, General Wesley Clark entered the race, and I thought, my God, it's coming with the speed of FedEx. Here's a four-star general who's decided that he wants to get into politics. That would be one way it could end. Another could be exactly what happened to the Soviet Union. Domestic economic rigidities making reform impossible. Imperial overstretch, which is what the 725 bases amounts to. There's not a person in the United States, in the military or in the Pentagon, who would argue that we need those 725 military bases in order to defend our country. And then, ultimately, the inability to reform, being stopped, as was Mikhail Gorbachev in Russia, by vested interests in the old Cold War military structure. Do those vested interests exist here? To ask the question is to answer it, that for a politically well-connected capitalist today, the amounts of the profits that you can make in servicing the armed forces, supplying them with weapons and things of this sort, are phenomenal. The world's largest munitions maker, Lockheed Martin, its profits went up well over 25% last year. When war becomes that profitable, you can be fairly certain you're going to see more of it.
And that was Chalmers Johnson talking about his new book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, just published by Metropolitan Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week, also on recording, another conference, another trip out of town. And let's go out with the fifth of the five piano pieces, Opus 23, by Arnold Schoenberg, performed by Glenn Gould. Till next week, goodbye.